Thank you for being here. So today we'll talk about proof field theory. In dimension 4 minus epsilon. And so the main purpose of the talk is to explain what do I mean by that and why would it be useful for, and present a few preliminary results. So for those of you who were present at last week's conference, I will kind of repeat myself a bit, but I hope that doing it on a blackboard could be an opportunity to have more questions and exchanges, especially if I'm not clear enough. So I hope, feel free to interrupt whenever. And so just to set the stage, what are group field theories? So they are usually thought of as a way of summing, there are field theories which are thought of as a way of summing spinform models, spinform amplitudes. And in the spinform literature, usually the main focus is really on the geometric aspects. So the constraints, imposing certain geometric conditions. And the other aspects, the combinatorial aspects, are usually not really analyzed, and they are a source of issues, especially in GFTs. So this changed recently thanks to some new work in tensor models. So you all know them by starting with pioneering papers by Razvan in 2010 or 9, I don't know. And so these ideas coming from tensor models applied to GFTs now allow ourselves to construct to study renormalizability properties of these GFTs. So this together to cook up a renormalization theory for group field theories. So I will talk mainly about that. And let me give you the outline of the talk. So first, I will introduce, remind you what the existence of a 3D quantum gravity TGFT model. And I will try to outline what are the main differences with the usual Bulatov model, for example, in group field theory. Then I will tell you how you can analytically continue the dimension of the group. So here the group will be SU2 of dimension 3, and I will analytically continue in some sense the dimension of this group to dimension 4 minus epsilon. And finally, I will conclude with the first computations, which show that there, in these models, there is a Wilson, the analog of the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. So there is an analog of the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, and I will explain how you can see it, what needs to be done to confirm it in the SU2 case, and why can it be useful for? What can it be useful for? Questions at this stage, just for on the motivation, so, no? Okay, so let's start with the, so here I will mainly repeat like the key steps of the constructions I did last week. So, as a reminder, let's start with informals in 3D. So this is the usual Ponzano AG model. So how do we come to this kind of model? So we start from gravity in BF formulation. So in 3D, gravity is just BF, so there are no additional constraints to impose. And then we discretize the path integral, defining the quantum theory. So the main idea is that basically you start from the continuous ill-defined partition function like this, which is so an integral over triads and over spin connections of the action of BF theory, so which is trace E wedge the curvature of the connection. So heuristically, this is the same as the measures the set of flat connections on the manifold M. So, and the purpose of the Ponzano-Reggie model is to give a discretized version of this flat connection, the flat connection condition. So, and the third step in this construction, which is still kind of open, is to recover at some stage some kind of continuum limit. So this might not be too important in 3D because we have the trivial model or things like that, but in 4D this step is very important. So and the point I want to make in this first part is that the way you discretize the path integral is essentially unconstrained, and depending on the choices you make, you might or might not be able to attack the third point of the construction. So by optimizing this discretization, you might be able to do more things than the usual Ponzano, that in with the usual Ponzano-Reggie model. So with this in mind, the standard setting in spin foams so is to discretize the manifold via simple shell complexes, so triangulations in a sense. So, and the elementary building blocks in 3D are therefore like tetrahedra. Okay, and the setting I will use, which is inspired by the recent works in TensorModel, is different. Is to use I will call them colored cellular complexes. I will explain what this means. And the building blocks won't be tetrahedra, but some kind of more general cell triangulated cells, discretized cells. So I will call them elementary cells. Okay, so now let me introduce you to this combinatorial data. So it's going to be a bit dry, but please ask questions if you don't understand, because it's kind of the important for the rest. So what are colored cellular complexes? So let's start with the building blocks. Uh, So the elementary building blocks are represented by so-called colored graphs. And in this dimension, there will be three colored graphs, which means there will be three colors. Maybe you don't see if I were here, right? So what are they? So they are built out of two types of nodes, black or white. And the edges which are incident to these nodes are colored by some label. And the labeling is such that at each node, there should be exactly one edge of a given color incident on the node. So same here. And the interpretation of these nodes is given by the following dual mapping, which is to a triangle. So let me draw it here. There's a dual triangle here. So each edge of the triangle is dual to an edge of the graph, and each triangle is dual to a node of the graph. Same here. Okay, and now when you construct a given graph, for example this, the simplest one is this one. So you see, so it's a one example of a colored graph. What does it mean? It means that you take two triangles, one here, and you glue 2x2 the dual edges of the triangle. So linking two nodes is interpreted in the dual picture as gluing two faces of a triangle, edges of the triangle. Is it clear? Okay, so let me give you more example of graphs. For example, you can have graphs with four nodes. This one, for example. So, and you see that it's colorable without any problem. And each node, you don't have any problem. And same for example, with six nodes, you can draw this one. And again, it's colorable. For example, you can do this. Okay. And okay, so these represent, strictly speaking, closed surfaces, triangulated surfaces, closed triangulated surfaces. But we are trying to describe 3D geometries. So what do I mean by this is an elementary cell? It's just that these graphs actually represent the boundary of a 3D chunk of space, and the boundary is triangulated in such a way as represented by the graph. Okay, so so bear this in mind. So the elementary cell, so the graph, the three colored graph, represents the boundary of an elementary cell. So let me give you an example which is easy to picture. So for example, you can consider this graph. Shaped like a cube. Okay. So I don't put the color labels, but you can check that it's colorable. And this represents, if you do the mapping I just explained, this represents kind of two pyramids glued together. So like this. Along their square bases. So is it clear? Or? So that's an elementary chunk, discretized chunk of the manifold we want to use. And there's these colored graphs represent infinitely many ways of splitting the original space into chunks. No, so in this case, in the models I will describe, it's related to the orientability properties of the discretized manifold they represent. But it's not very crucial at this stage. But in the literature, you can find only this kind of graphs.
Is any graph you can write realizable as the boundary of a domain?
Ah, no, no. Some graphs are, so to be exact, the mapping between the graph and the cell. So you should take the. So the cell is like the topological cone of the boundary. So you can have singularities, topological singularities. So it's not always a proper cell. But we'll see that in the models I will consider, these kind of cells, these kind of graphs, they don't contribute to the flow of renormalization. So they are washed away. They are irrelevant operators, if you want. So that's why I didn't introduce them here. But it's true that in these models, you allow for topological singularities. And in 3D, they are just point-like. You don't have extended singularities, just point-wise. Is it OK? Or? OK, so now, to obtain a colored cellular complex, you just glue these elementary chunk together. And so the way it's represented at the graph level is by introducing a new kind of line, which are represented as dotted. So if you have two bubbles like this, for example, so and here is something, bubble one. And another one here. So remember that these nodes represent triangles. So when I will identify two triangles, glue them together, I will represent it by a dotted line like this, which will have the color zero, a new type of color. OK? So and if I try to picture it in the triangulated version. So if you have one triangle triangulating a ball, the boundary of a ball here, so I don't represent the other ones, and another one here, well, this graph just amounts to identifying these two triangles together. OK? OK, so is this combinatorial kind of setting OK? So now let's come back to spin foam models. So if you want to implement a spin foam model on such a cellular decomposition of a manifold, you need to introduce holonomy variables, which allow to define a discrete connection in the manifold. And the way it's usually done is that you introduce in 3D, you introduce holonomies along paths, a path which are dual to the triangles of your decomposition. So here will be the same, and this will amount to equip these dotted lines with the holonomy elements. So there will be an element of SU2 associated to each color zero line. Okay, and to maybe a way of representing it is if you have a triangle here in the triangulation, which is at the boundary between two bubbles, one on this side and one on this side, the holonomy will be associated to the path going through the triangle between the two chunks of space you are describing. Okay? I don't know how to draw it, but do you understand? Or is it, so the holonomy variables associated to these lines will tell you how to parallel transport between two neighboring chunks of space. Is it fine? Or just like in the Ponzano-Reggio model, you have the same, except that the chunks of space are all tetrahedra. The simplest graph. Yeah, but yeah, no. You cannot actually the tetrahedral interaction you have in spin foams. You cannot represent it in this setting, but you have a lot more. So. No, but from any, if you want from another point, maybe I should say, is that from any, I don't know.
I guess what I'm really getting at is, did I miss it? What's the point of restricting to colorable graphs?
So the point is that we have a lot of technical tools coming from tensor models, where 1/n expansions and stuff like that. So it's more, it's not that there is a reason to restrict, but
no, I mean there is a reason that the surfaces compared to general graphs give you all kinds of jump, which don't need to push. So the scalar structure at least gives you something for
Also, let me say that it's a restriction, but also a generalization. So it's a restriction because you don't work with the triangulations, but things which have these colors and stuff. But it's a generalization because you have an infinitely many possible chunks of space, not just one, not just a tetrahedron. And you can map between the two versions, because if you have any triangulation of a manifold, you can perform what is called the barycentric subdivision of the triangulation, and you obtain a colored triangulation. And then you can group this colored triangulation into packets following the color structure, which are exactly the bubbles which I described here.
So implicitly, the colorability is a topological restriction.
Yeah.
Makes it manifold-like.
Yeah, especially at the GFT level, because at the GFT level you have a generating functional, so you don't really, you cannot discard some of. If you work in the simplicial setting, you generate every possible degenerate configuration that you can imagine. While in this setting, you allow only for pseudo manifolds, so you have manifolds with point-like singularities in 3D, which is better. And you can, in a second step, show that the pseudo-manifold ones are actually suppressed as compared to some of the manifold ones. So. Okay, and okay. And the key. So in this setting, in this holonomy formulation, the key thing to implement in 3D is the flatness constraint. So what are they in this discrete setting? So I guess you are all familiar with this kind of thing. You should impose that the holonomy around closed path are trivial. So, and these paths are called faces. So you should take the oriented product around the face, an elementary face of the elementary holonomies I just spoke about, and you should impose this in the amplitude. So the amplitude will be, so this is a graph, this is the amplitude of a graph, should be proportional to the integral over all the holonomy variables. Sorry. Of the product of all the faces and of this constraint. And now the faces in this colored setting, let me tell you what they are. So there will be faces dual to the elementary edges of the triangles, which appear in your cellular complex. So there will be loops around these triangles, and to track them at the graph level, you just have to follow the bicolored elementary path of lines of color zero and whatever color. So, for example, one. Let me give an example. So this is a face, for example, in a colored graph. And remember that these support holonomy variables. And these deltas appear. There is one such delta for each face. So for example, here you should impose delta of H1, H2, H3, H4. So you should impose flatness in this discrete sense. Okay, questions? Yeah. Or you can,
I mean, because if I do a path integral for a particle, non-relativistic particle, I kind of break it up into steps and I maybe use the linear approximation. I mean, step and kind of trivialize the dynamics for short steps. But the fact that that makes sense has to do with, you know, the properties of the quantum propagator of a particle. Whereas if I'm talking about quantum geometry, unless I believe that the quantum geometry has a very simple sort of linear nature at the shortest scale, then it wouldn't make sense to me that I should impose a flatness condition at the shortest scale. Am I thinking?
So yeah, it's in 3D. Yeah.
But wouldn't you want to do the same thing in 4D?
No, but you wouldn't impose flatness.
Okay.
You would have the same kind of constraints I will talk about, but even more of them, so which will break this flatness at the but this is a kind of playing ground for the 4D case. For now, we have nothing in the 4D case. So. Okay, so let me now come to GFTs. So if you want to write a GFT that generates such amplitudes and such cellular complexes, let me explain how you should proceed. So I was staying at the level of one graph until now, one discretization. Now we want to sum over them. So we'll consider a field theory with one field, phi, going from three copies of SU2 to the complex numbers. And then we want to write a partition function for this field with the following standard structure. So an integral with respect to some Gaussian measure of covariance C. Times exponential minus the interaction action, which is a function of phi and phi bar. Okay. And so now in GFTs, the choice of S is motivated by the choice of discretizations, the type of discretizations you want to generate. And the choice of the covariance is determined by the choice of dynamics you want to impose on them, so the structure of the amplitudes. So let's start with S. So if I want to generate the cellular complexes I was talking about, you need to take to impose that S is a sum of what is called a tensorial invariant. So they are indexed by the graphs I was talking about, the bubble graphs. So and here is a coupling constant times some invariant. And so let me explain how to map the graph to the invariant. So I'll take the simplest example, maybe this one. So to each white dot, you should associate a field and a conjugate field to the other one. And then you should convolute the arguments according to this pattern, where each color, the color one, represents the position, the first position of the in the SU2 copies. So this would be an integral over three group elements here of what? So phi bar. And so the first argument of phi should be, according to this drawing, the first argument should be identified with the first argument of phi bar. So you have this. And same for the others. So this is just the scalar product. Okay. And maybe I can give another example, a bit more complex. So if you look at the four-valent graph here, so again, you put a field phi here, a phi bar here, phi here, phi bar here. And then you write the integral over how many group elements? 6, the number of lines. And so you have a phi bar here, phi here, phi bar. So how should you convolute the arguments of the field? So for example, the phi bar here should have the first two group elements identified with this one, so like this. Okay. Now the third argument of this one should be identified with this one. So you can do this. Okay. Et cetera, et cetera. I don't need to maybe to, I mean, if you can do it. For example, G4, G5 here should be identified with this two. And there is a last one here. So, okay. So this is the invariant represented by this B. All right. So in the sense of field theories, there are non-local interactions of a very specific type. Questions or? So you have to choose the covariance, the propagator. I'm coming to that. So for the covariance, it should impose the dynamics on the field. On this is how you control the amplitudes. Because, okay, thanks to this, to the choice of action, if you expand now perturbatively in the coupling constant, you will have that Z is the sum over the graphs I was talking about before times the amplitude of a graph. Okay, this you get. And now the specific value of the amplitude is determined by the covariance. So if you want to get AG proportional to the delta functions I was talking about before. So so if you want this, you need to choose your propagator as such. So you need to have so let me write it and then explain. Need to have something like this, okay? So the variable h here is what will what I was talking about, what I was referring to as hl before, in the graph setting. So for each propagator, the dotted lines, the dashed lines I was introducing before, you have some h here, and then you have trivial identifications between these deltas identify the endpoints of the, so they glue the triangles together up to this H parallel transport. Okay? Okay, so the problem with this formulation, of course, is that there are many divergences. Why? Just because there are too many deltas in general. You impose redundant constraints. And so the route we have been following in GFT is to modify this covariance with some non-trivial differential operator on top. So just let me mention it. So maybe, yeah, there are two things you can do. You can either regularize the delta function to some delta or gamma, where gamma is some cutoff on the spin labels in on SU2. So you can expand delta in spin labels, and you can tame the high spins in some way. So either with a heat kernel regularization or some trap cutoff, it doesn't matter. And then you can try to look for so-called 1 over n expansions, where actually n is played by the role of n is gamma, it's just the cutoff. And you try to scale the coupling constants in such a way to find appropriate scalings for the coupling constant in gamma in such a way that you have a well-defined 1 over n expansion. So this is one way. And the other way, which I want to talk about, is to try to dynamically realize this kind of scalings, which are imposed by hand in this case, by introducing a non-trivial operator instead of just delta functions. So a non-trivial kinetic term in a sense. So, and this is what we've been doing essentially last year's. So I will talk about that. And so you can do it, for example, by introducing a propagator, a standard one, in minus some minus the Laplacian of SU2 cube, like this. Okay. So now, instead of using the covariant for the covariance, this operator, you use this operator times this one. And what you obtain is a modified covariance. Which will look like this. Let me write it and then explain. So if you compare this formula to the one there, you just replace the delta functions by heat kernels. So this is a heat kernel on SU2. So in a sense, you regularize the delta functions. And this is the time alpha appearing in the heat kernel. And then you integrate over the regulator with some weight given by the mass. Okay. And what's nice is that all the divergences, as usual in quantum field theories, they come from the small parameter, small Schwinger parameter alpha. So a way to regularize the theory is just to impose a cutoff here. So cutting off the small alphas. And so this gamma squared is equivalent to a smooth cutoff on the spins. Okay, and the spin levels in the harmonic decompositions and of functions on SU2. Okay, just to relate to the spin form language. Okay, so now when you're in this setting, then you can study renormalizability, renormalization of the theory, and look for whether the theory reproduces itself when you move the cutoff here. And if it does, what are the properties? So just to mention the results, and then I will come to the 4 minus epsilon. So the results are that the SU2 model, this model I took me so long to introduce, is renormalizable up to 5-6 interactions. that is to say that the effective action, if you want, can be parameterized like this. So some constant T2 times the first drawing I was introducing, the scalar product, plus T4 times the other one I was mentioning, essentially. And plus, finally, two kinds of 5-6 interactions. One is something like this. And the second one is something like this. So the details don't matter, really. It's just to give you an idea. And all the other bubbles at higher valences, or the bubbles which represent topological singularities, they are all irrelevant. So we can discard them. So the only relevant operators are these ones. And moreover, you can study their flows and show that they go to zero in the UV. So in the, you can show that, for example, the T6 coupling constants. So to be, yeah, they go to zero when gamma. So sorry, I forgot the gamma here. When the cutoff is removed, so it's asymptotically free. Okay. So yeah, so here UV means large spins actually. So where the divergences come from? We take really a field theory stance and.
So your philosophy here is that you're paralleling what's done in ordinary quantum field theory.
Yes.
But there, the UV divergences come from superposing amplitudes of like all these short distance degrees of freedom in the theory. Mm. Whereas here, like if I'm talking about 3D gravity, there are no short distance degrees of freedom in the theory.
No.
So, but nevertheless, you have divergences.
Mm.
So I would think, okay, those are a different kind of divergence. They're not, they shouldn't be thought of as parallel to ordinary QFT divergences. So should I be applying ordinary QFT methods of a conceptual approach of renormalization to them? Maybe they should be dealt with in a different way, like eliminated a priori or something.
Yeah, that's a possibility, I think, but. So,
it can be done. If you start from the Fonzano rigid model, one way to get rid of the divergences in the first place is by the form of the gauge
rigid. Yeah, but.
This is similar to the divergence of the study of a gauge rigid model. So there is a sort of generalized method to remove the divergences.
But this works, this works just, can I just answer Matthäus? So you can do this, but only at a level of one graph, so one discretization. If you try to use the GFT formalism to sum over these, the gauge fixing doesn't work, because you have only the field theory, so. So the source of inspiration, I guess, in GFT is really matrix models.
Yeah.
where you use some of our contributions, triangulations, and you try to reach some kind of continuum limit. And this setting is consistent with the picture, at least. It's not motivated completely from this picture, but it's consistent because the flow is from large spins to smaller ones, which is consistent, which means that it's consistent with the fact that we are trying to reach a limit where we have many building blocks with small spins. So this is, in this sense, it's not inconsistent. Yeah, it's an abstract notion of scale. It's not related to the short scale of space-time physics. No.
It's not.
But in 4D, you wouldn't look for a topological. So I agree that in 3D it's not completely, it's not really motivated, this kind of, because you can, as I was saying, you can use the trivial model, for example. But in 4D, you are supposed to do something about, you're not looking for a topological phase, so. Okay. So actually, the starting point of the results I wanted to maybe present in more details is the fact that, so okay, now we understand well the flow close to the Gaussian fixed point of this model, and the question is really how does the theory behaves away from the Gaussian fixed point. And in particular, do we have a non-trivial fixed point? Okay, and the way I want to investigate it is by analogy with the scalar field theories, usual scalar field theories. So let me come to the second part, which is the analytic constitution. So just a quick reminder, for scalar field theories, you know that in space-time dimension 4, you can look at the five-four model, which is perturbatively renormalizable. And in D equals to 3, you have a 5-6 model. Okay. So the question is really, and you can understand some properties of the d equal 3 model by looking at the d equal 4 minus epsilon. And the question is, can we have something like this in GFTs? The answer is yes. Let me see why. So in GFT, we have, so for the I am in dimension 3 here as far as space-time is concerned. But now the group G equal SU2 has dimension 3. And I will note big D, the dimension of the group. And so staying in this case, so three space-time dimensions, but varying the dimension of the group, you can actually see that, so in D equal 3, you have a 5-6 renormalizable model. And in D equal 4, you have exactly like in the scalar field, with the scalar fields, you have a, you can look at a 5-4 renormalizable model. And so I want to investigate what happens in dimension 4 minus epsilon. And so to do that, of course, analytically continue SU2 is a bit strange. So what I propose to do is to change SU2 into a group G, which is SU2 times compact dimensions, D minus 3 compact dimensions like this, given by U1, a factor U1 to the D minus 3. Okay. So that's the first step. So then you can compute amplitudes, et cetera, with the arbitrary D in this setting. And then you change D to, you send D to 4 minus epsilon. So that's the way I want to analytically continue the dimension of the group. Yeah. No. The idea is really to study fixed points in a sense. I can explain now if you want. So the good news is that there is a fixed non-trivial fixed point in dimension 4 minus epsilon, just like in for scalar field theories. Let me be quick here. So in scalar field theories, so you have that in D equal 4 minus epsilon, the 5-4 coupling constant, let me call it U4, the dimensionless one, acquires some dimensional factor here, dimensional canonical dimension epsilon, which first makes this coupling relevant and not only marginally relevant, and in a second stage allows you to find a non-trivial fixed point of order epsilon for U4. So if you impose that the beta function is zero, you can easily find that there is a non-trivial fixed point which is of order epsilon, and same for U2, the coupling constant of the mass term, which is proportional in this case to minus epsilon times a constant. Okay, so this is what happens in scalar field theories. And if I represent this on a graph, so you have, here's the U2 coupling, the U4. So you have the Gaussian fixed point here, which is unstable in this direction and in this direction. And you have a new fixed point, the Wilson-Fisher one, which is unstable in the direction of the mass and stable in the direction in this direction. Okay. And so why is it interesting? Because it can allow you to understand how the theory flows away from the Gaussian fixed point. So for example, a characteristic trajectory will leave the fixed point like this, and then it will be repelled by the non-trivial fixed point here, the Wilson-Fisher one. And so you have a natural focusing of the coupling constants along this trajectory. Okay, so that's why it's interesting in a sense. And the key point is that in this case, this qualitative drawing survives when you send epsilon to 1. So that is when you in D equal 3, okay? So the qualitative features survive. And then if you want to study it more in depth, the 3D case. You can use, for example, the functional renormalization group flow equation. And so that's the key thing to do this once you understand that there might exist such a fixed point, thanks to dimension from any subset. And so if we do that in GFTs, so let me be short because I don't have any time left. So what happens actually is that you have exactly the same kind of feature appearing, except for one point, so which is that the in TGFTs, because of the non-local interactions you have, the already at the first loop orders, you have the wave function renormalization is important, contributes to the flow. And so the signs here can change. So for example, if you study the phi 4 model, which in scalar field theories has a lambda ghost, so the model is trivial. In tensorial group field theory, this does not happen because the beta functions changes sign thanks to wave function counterterms. So and here the same happens, and as a result, what happens is that the fixed point is not in the same corner. So you have the Gaussian fixed point here. Then you have the Wilson-Fischer fixed point have positive mass but negative phi 4 coupling constant like this. Okay. Otherwise, the structure is similar. Okay. And so this is of order epsilon, and same here. So this is the picture in dimension 4 minus epsilon that you get. So there is a Wilson-Fischer fixed point, and the key difference is this. So you have a kind of mirror with respect to the mirror symmetry with respect to the usual scalar field theories. Okay, and now the big question I want to investigate from this kind of a preliminary result is what happens when you send epsilon to 1. And so I think it's important to try to develop the functional renormalization group techniques in this case, and investigate directly the existence of a non-trivial fixed point in the G equal SU2 case. And so physically, what might be very interesting in this, so let me conclude with some possible directions. What might be interesting is that if there is such a fixed point in the SU2 case, this might indicate that you have natural flows from the Gaussian fixed point, which leads you to a massive theory. Okay, so a theory where the mass dominates over the Laplace term in the kinetic term. And so this could be a nice bridge between the kind of field theories I was constructing with the modified propagators and the cutoff model, the cutoff models, where you look for 1/n expansion and you don't have a non-trivial kinetic term. And so, for example, the kind of regularized Bulatov model, if you wish. So actually, this model I was introducing might be a kind of UV completion in some field theory sense of the cutoff models, which have been on the market for a while now. So this would be interesting in my view. And maybe a few other points. So there might be also a link. So the question, if the fixed point exists when epsilon equals to 1, would be are all the relevant operators switched on, or only the FIFO and a few other terms? So, and so our operators, relevant operators, switch on at epsilon equal to 1. And so, and here there might be a link with the non-perturbative resummation results in tensor models. So for those who were at the conference, the ones Razvan was introducing. So he was summing over all so-called Mellonic contributions. And the Mellonic contributions are exactly the ones that are relevant for the flow equations. So if all the coupling constants become of order 1, let's say, or I mean non-zero, there might be a point where you can resum all of them. Non-perturbative tensors. And okay, and another question I'm wondering whether there's any relevance to the fact that there is a sign shift between usual scalar field theories and this one. So I don't know. I didn't think about it yet. So, and that's it. Sorry for the messy discussion. Yeah.
Can you explain how the fact that the mass is defined to be relevant? How is that good that the mass is relevant? This mass term which you introduced as a gadget for regular.
No, actually the mass term is the one that is already there in the usual bullet of model. The mass is just the term proportional to the identity on the group. So it's the one that you have already in bullet of model. The one you add is the Laplacian. So that's why I was saying that there might be a bridge between the two stories, because if you have this formalism here, the dimensionless mass becomes grows along the flow along towards the IR, and at some point it becomes it dominates the Laplacian term, so you can discard the Laplacian term. Yeah, but that's okay. Since you don't know what the coupling constant is, it doesn't matter. It's just a rescaling of. So in the bullet of model, you have one in the propagator and then some lambda. But you don't know the. What's important is just the rate between the coefficients, in front of the propagator and the one in front of the coupling and the interaction. So. Yes. Yeah, but so we're not talking about propagating degrees of freedom.
Right.
The,
So usually when you have a fixed point in front of the piece, it's associated with a critical surface where the correlation is divergent. That means a piece with a degree of freedom property. That's exactly what you don't want in 3D.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about fields on the. I'm not talking about fields on the manifold or on the discrete manifold.
So this is a physical degree of freedom.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah. I mean.
Okay. So why do you want it?
What?
A physical
degree of freedom? No, but the field is, sorry. So the fields are here to generate your, if you wish, in your language, your ensemble of discrete structures. On which you,
yeah. So you want a continuous
So you want to reach what?
So do you want a continuum, degree of freedom to create discrete structures? I'm not sure I understand the philosophy.
So let me try to. So first, so the field here is has nothing to do with the field I was talking about. It's not the field on space-time or whatever. So the fact that it has propagating degrees of freedom or not, it's not related to the fact that there is or not propagating degrees of freedom on space-time. No, I don't think so. I mean, so here the point, yeah. Fine. So I want to reach a point in a sense where all the coupling constants I was talking about are turned on, so that you sum over more and more complex stuff. And this is difficult to study, so I was trying to look at the 4 minus epsilon case, and okay, it seems that,
I think it's a related question, but it's how you ultimately would use this sort of margin flow information. So normally, if I understand it, we have a normalizable theory that it takes a finite number of couplings to specify it, but they flow.
Mm.
And then the way I use it is I specify the momentum scale at which I'm probing the physics. And then, you know, I say the couplings have a certain value at that scale. And then I know there's a finite number of them I need to specify. And some things are irrelevant at that scale of energy.
Mm.
Whereas here, the scale, quote unquote, is the spin.
Yeah.
It's not directly related to energy or you know, translational momentum. And I don't know how I would probe this theory at a particular spin. I mean, I do know, I think, mathematically, but from a physics point of view, could you use the information? Suppose I have a theory that's renormalizable in this sense.
Yeah.
But I need to probe it, the physics, at a certain energy scale, not a certain spin scale. And how do I use the information that you're getting to do physics with that theory?
So that's, I think, the tricky part is that, so in this kind of a scenario, the idea would be then, in a second stage, once you understand better these theories, to try to understand how very complicated boundary states with many building blocks with small spins, which look approximately continuous, how do they behave in such, if you plug them in this model. And only then I think you could maybe relate it to some physical scale in a space-time sense. So it's, I don't know if I'm clear, but so let's say that from a physical perspective, the idea is that if you believe that in such spinform models, let's say, you would like to, at the end of the day, describe some geometry, continuous geometry, by a collection of many, many simplices of small size. If you believe this, then this
right there. Yeah. Why should I believe in that? I don't see normally energy plays a crucial role in governing what part or aspect of a dynamics we're probing. I could declare mathematically I'm interested in boundary states that have small spin, but will nature allow me to probe such states? I mean, what am I actually looking at when I'm looking at the phenomenology of quantum gravity? Is it going to be small spins that are relevant, or is that just a mathematical choice you're talking about making?
But
or does that matter? Maybe the question isn't the right one.
So it's a bit difficult to answer at this stage because what we miss is really the continuum limit, in a sense, to map what we understand from these models or what we don't understand from these models to
right,
some space-time.
Continuum limit. Think about how we use so let's take QCD. It's renormalizable, but it's divergent.
Mm-hmm.
But we can still calculate with it. Why? Well, we fix some quantities at a physical scale that we know how to probe.
Yeah, so let's say
what it means to fix them.
Yeah, so let's say
but do we know what it means to fix things at a particular
at this stage
scale?
We don't know at all.
Yeah.
So to be just
so mostly
it's not very physical, even for the term. It's not really one
of the
other. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
so
it's a maybe a stepping stone towards. Yeah. Yeah. It's similar to the matrix size and matrix model. Yeah. So. It's also some messy matrix. And it's also a good question what happens.
Actually, the one that brings to mind the one example of matrix models that I sort of know about, isn't it believed that sort of underlying ABS-CFT is some very large N matrix model? But the physics we think we understand is the very large N, not the small N. Very large matrix.
Yeah, so this is also here, it's clear that the large N limit or the large N limit would have the model.
So maybe it's large spins rather than small spins.
Yeah, I mean.
You know, maybe the whole prime macroscopic geometry context is a huge number of stable dots, stable dots, small spins.
But, okay, but the point is that's an arbitrary.
Not the case, then let's end.